Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. It's just a really, really nice little jewel in the South Pacific, which is a strategic nuclear sub-outlet, and we're dredging our harbours to allow for aircraft nuclear power carriers as well. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. You can't go wrong when you've got nuclear domination in your waters. My very amazing, spectacular, somewhat ridiculously fabulous guest is Joel McDermott. Joel, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I've never had an introduction like that before.
I know. Somebody told me that everybody introduces themselves as my very special guest. So I figure, you know, why don't we just introduce some vocabulary into it? It's just as meaningless, but it sounds way, way better.
Gotcha. I may come back. I like that.
I think it is a good idea. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do for those who are unfamiliar?
Oh, absolutely. A friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours, recommended this a show for me basically because I work for a Christian ministry, and that may sound odd maybe to a lot of your guests, I'm not sure, but I work for a Christian ministry in the United States called American Vision, and I work a lot in the realm of politics, economics, somewhat foreign policy, really what we would say giving biblical ideas, biblical principles behind social policy. And in the past, that's largely been done by leftists. And it wasn't until the middle of last century that a group of guys began to look over Scripture, look at actually some of Old Testament law and some other principles and say, wait a minute, this is not at all what it teaches. Why should the leftists have the death grip on the Bible here? And they began to teach some of those principles themselves and found out, what do you know? There's actually free market principle here. There's actually a very limited role for government. There's actually a very limited role for foreign policy. There's actually a strong indictment against war and things of that nature. There's a very strong indictment against a standing army. And so they began to write and codify some of these things. And I'm kind of the second to third generation of that movement. And I've been writing for about the past 5 to 6 years in this genre. And I found out that I have a lot of overlap with a lot of libertarians and actually quite a bit with some anarchists, or if you would say anarcho-capitalists, in that realm as well. So a lot of criticism of big government, of statism, of everything that goes along with that. And it's led to a lot of interesting relationships, if you will. And here we are today.
What got you into this yourself personally? How'd you get involved?
Oh, well, that's a long, long story. I have
we have time, and I love long stories.
It's actually, I'm trying to think where to start. You know, there's always the personal testimony, and then there's the personal testimony that's relevant. So I'm trying to think where to parse that out. But
I'd say give us both, and that way the listeners can work it out for themselves.
Works for me. Well, I was raised in probably what you consider a typical mainstream American home. Nominal Christian, church on Sundays, but not a whole lot of ideology from any perspective, really. It was public schooling. It was, you know, day-to-day, watch TV, get your news from the 6 o'clock news type stuff. And it wasn't until I was about 19, I suppose. I was about 17 when my mom divorced for the second time, which is also becoming more mainstream American and certainly modern. And that kind of left me on my own. I left the family situation and just kind of went off, did my own thing. Met some friends who were going to a different type of church, which was Pentecostal. And I started going to church with them when I was about 19. And my friend and I were both members of a rock and roll band. I was a guitarist and he was a singer. And when he decided to get back in church, he decided to take his talents. He was also a drummer and play for the church band. So he invited me. And the next thing I know, I was driving church buses and playing for the church band too. And it was about that time, around 19, 20 years old, that I got serious about studying Scripture. And it was one day I remember making a conscious decision. I said, if I'm going to do this Christian thing, I'm going to sit down and do it right. And so I just cracked open the Bible and started reading. And that was 20 years ago almost, and has been a constant study ever since, and a lot of changes, a lot of decisions and things of that nature along the way. But that friend of mine and me are still very close friends today, although we live quite a ways apart. And it was through my studies that I eventually left the Pentecostal church and what some Christians would consider the pure fundamentalist world, and went into the Reformed camp, which is smaller but much older. And that's where I began my what I would consider my serious studies, and really began to get into scholarship. And around the year 2000, I guess it was 2004, when I finally got to seminary, I'd finished a bachelor's degree in philosophy and rhetoric in the state of Arkansas, and in the U.S. And then went to seminary for 3 years in Pennsylvania, got a Master of Divinity degree. And after that, I got a job with the ministry I currently work for. And during the same time, I completed a doctorate degree from Pretoria in South Africa. And that actually is a great program because they allow you to do it by distance. You and I are sitting here talking by Skype, and I actually did my oral defense of my dissertation by Skype with video. It was pretty interesting. But anyway, so along those lines, and after many years of study, I am where I am today. And I kind of fell in with this group of guys that are doing social theory from a biblical perspective. And it turns out our studies lead us into a pretty radical free market perspective. And so that's the stuff I write. I challenge not only the left, but the conservative party in the United States. I'm oftentimes getting pelted with tomatoes, or figuratively speaking, from Republicans and conservatives because I criticize their guys, but it's due. It's absolutely due. They're just as big a statists as the left is in many cases, in most cases. And that's where I've ended up today. And I write on broad range of topics, everything from pure biblical studies, theology, end times doctrines, which is the Christian doctrine of eschatology. That's huge. And a lot of people don't realize that, but that's absolutely huge, especially in the United States. A huge force behind the statist push, especially in foreign policy and support for it, the modern state of Israel. So we write a lot about that. But again, like I said, we deal with social theory and social policy, do a lot of work on law, the nature of law, and things of that nature. I write on court cases. I published a book last year called Restoring America, One County at a Time. The basic principle in it is the concept of decentralization of power. And that book covers 10 broad topics: education, welfare, local government, state government, markets, courts, defense. I forget all the other ones off the top of my head, but there were 10 topics that I covered in that, all from a biblical perspective, all what maybe many of your listeners would recognize as a radical free market libertarian perspective, but from my background, it's a biblical perspective. And so that overlap, like I said, has created a tremendous amount of interesting relationships from all the way from friends of mine I have in the Republican Party here in the state of Georgia in the U.S., to libertarians and anarchists and all kinds of guys, even atheists, who, you know, they and I would be on, you know, on fighting terms in a different context, but here we are holding a considerable amount of common ground in social theory.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's on the points you agree you should come together and collaborate, and those that you disagree, you can kind of leave those arguments for another time. Probably it would be good to leave it for a time when we're not currently under the threat of domination by criminal, ruthless, sociopathic scum.
Absolutely, and I think that's where it comes down to. A lot of what happens is, from a biblical perspective, is absolutely criminal. Statism is criminal. And from, you know, one of the basic passages we always teach on, and I'm not sure what your background in Christianity or the Bible is, but one of the basic passages we always come back to is in the book of 1 Samuel. This was fairly early in Israel's history. And she was never intended to have a monarchy. She was never intended to have a ruler of that nature, an executive power, if you will, and certainly not a legislature. And at this point in Israel's history, people began to lose faith in the system of government they were given, which was basically self-government under God. And they came to Samuel, who was their prophet and kind of their prophetic leader, and said, "We want a king like all the other nations around us have." Are you familiar with this passage at all?
No, I haven't actually read the Bible, but I'm receptive.
Good. Oh, well, you'll find this interesting then. So they come to Samuel and they say, "We want a king like all the other nations around us have." Well, here, according to the biblical narrative, God's given these people the best form of government that can be given. It's self-government under God. Nobody's telling you what to do. You don't have rulers regulating every aspect of your life, as you said earlier, the criminal junta or whatever. And yet they want to be like these other nations. What do the other nations have? They had great kings, great leaders, usually men of great physical stature, who were representative military rulers. They were representative of conquest. And these people who are supposed to be living in peace and prosperity and under God's law are saying, "Hey, wait a minute. We want to be like these other nations who have this symbol of national greatness by which they go out into battle and conquer other nations." And the text says that Samuel was infuriated about this. Why would the people depart from the good life to go fight the thug life, to go live the thug life? And so he prays to God, and God says to him, "You can give them what they want, and they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me." God says this is a rejection of him. Statism is a rejection of God. That's what he says. And he tells Samuel to give them what they ask for. You know, it reminds me of H.L. Mencken's quote that democracy is that form of government in which the people get what they ask for, good and hard. And it was kind of that on display in ancient Israel. And but God says, you give them what they ask for, but tell them what it's really going to be like. And in this passage in the eighth chapter of 1 Samuel, he says, here's the manner of the king that will come. He's going to take your sons and conscript them for military service. He's going to take your daughters and your sons and conscript them for state service, compulsory national service. He's going to take a tenth of your income, which, by the way, wouldn't we love to return to that level of tyranny from modern times? He's going to take a tenth of your fields and your crops. He's going to take your property. And he goes through this long list of tyrannies that this king was going to impose upon them. And when they thought that they were achieving national greatness through having some great military leader, they were actually inviting upon themselves tyranny in the form of statism. And they get it. They get who was known in the Bible as King Saul. And of course, we could go on and teach history from there for a long perspective. What happens in Israel? Well, it's basically national decline, because it's one tyranny after another, and it's not until King David comes along that you get some restoration of freedom. Even then, it's not entirely restored. And so what you have is a people who have freedom in their hands, and they throw it away because they think something greater is before them, and the something greater is always military conquest. And that was absolutely forbidden according to God's law. It was not only not stated, it was absolutely forbidden. Now, there were laws that God provided for them in Deuteronomy 17 on the day that they ever did decide they wanted a king. And he says, if you do have a king, he may not multiply horses, which is an offensive military weapon. In other words, you can't have a standing army. He may not multiply gold and silver. In other words, he couldn't have a large treasury. And he could not multiply wives, which for royalty in those days was a means of forming international alliances. And actually, that existed clear up into the Middle Ages, probably even to today. And so you had all these restrictions upon an executive if they wanted to have one. And yet when they get one, he just kind of blows all those laws out of the water, and the state takes over, and the people are subjected to tyranny, and the history of Israel goes downhill from there until somewhat, 400 years later or so, they're in the Babylonian captivity. So, you know, that's a lot of history from the Bible in a nutshell, but the point is that you have this basic doctrine of self-government under God. It's attainable. You can have it. All you got to do is keep the right principles in place, love your neighbor as yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not satisfied with that. And in not being satisfied with that, the population is the one that demands the tyrannies that we get. And once the tyrannies are in place, what do? They just grow, they breed, they propagandize, they use the very means by which they were established to grow themselves. And the next thing you know, you have Federal Reserve systems, you have fractional reserve banking, you have unlimited means of funding these tyrannies, which also is directly against biblical law. Not only were the governments forbidden to have a large treasury, but they were forbidden to dilute the money supply. They were forbidden to use, in biblical terms, false weights and measures. You shall have one weight and one measure in your bag. That pertains to all conducting of business, and it means you should have one standard of payment, and everything should be honest. You should have, as I would put it, honest money. Well, the moment the government begins inflating the money supply or diluting the money supply and the banks are involved and all that kind of stuff, what are you doing? You're literally robbing from the public through this means. You're robbing from future generations in the amount of their wealth and using that to fund the immediate causes of the state and the state's cronies.
Well, the way the state would look at that is we're going to kill most of the future generations, so technically we're not robbing from them.
Well, I mean, that comes right down to it too, doesn't it? You know, what's a little bit of theft if you're going to add murder on top of it? I mean,
when you kill one, what was it Stalin said? When you kill one, it is a statistic. Oh, what was it? It's a tragedy. But
tragedy.
When you kill 10 million, it is a statistic.
It's a statistic, and you get the black book of communism out of it. Yeah, no, it's true, and whether that's direct conspiracy or whatever, it doesn't matter. That's the way things go, and it's the way things went.
Conspiracy is like human history in a nutshell. It's nothing but conspiracy after conspiracy after conspiracy. It'll get up, it'll get bad. It's kind of like a virus. You know how, I don't know if you've seen the very microscopic pictures of viruses, but they look like a rocket ship. And I was starting to think about the fractal universe theory, how everything's just kind of like a smaller version of something else. And I thought about, what if humans were in a rocket ship and then we went to a planet, and then we got out of the rocket ship, started building up our civilization, and then infect the planet, totally balls it up, and then jump in our rocket ship and go into another one and infect that. And then you have a look at how a cell works, and that's exactly how, the exact same thing. It comes in, pops into a cell, injects itself, corrupts the cell, destroys it, and then moves on to another area.
Well, I totally agree. And I would say statism and those who are part of it, are part of the virus. And, of course, that was the theme of The Matrix, right? But does it have to be that way is the bottom line. It seems like even those few of us who say, no, it doesn't have to be that way, are up against the billions who either don't care or are completely oblivious to the issue. Then you have the few on the other side who say, you know, absolutely, we'll do this and we'll get away with it and you can't stop us.
Do you think we actually need contrast in order to define who it is we are and what right is versus wrong?
I don't see how you would avoid it as right and wrong. If there's no contrast, there's no difference.
I was just thinking about that as well, because it's almost as if you need a tyranny in order for people to value freedom, and you need freedom in order for people to want tyranny. Isn't that strange? It's like a weird two-headed snake that's eating itself from both directions.
Well, I see what you're saying. No doubt. I mean, we get lulled to sleep over time. One of the great things about studying the Bible is that, I mean, here's a book. And by the way, there's a lot of difficult stuff in the Bible. I understand that. But here's a book that's been written covering a period of history over 6,000 years, roughly, depending on how you look at it. We'll say 6,000 years, okay? The thing you've just said is captured in Scripture. It's captured with Noah's generation. It's captured later with the next generation. It's captured in the generation of Babel after that. It's captured in Abraham's generation. It's captured after that in Moses in Egypt. It's captured after that with Samuel and Saul. It's captured after that over and over and over, all through Scripture. You see the same story over and over and over, that there is an ideal there that people could have if they would just want it. If they would just understand it, see it, and reach out and grab it. And yet they don't. They reach out for power. They reach out for lust. They reach out for tyranny over other people. Usually involves tyrannizing themselves in the process. And why is that? Well, what you see are this pattern you're just talking about, you know, but along with that comes forms of judgment that set things back to right. There are discontinuities in history just as much as there are patterns in history. And I'm not sitting here saying we can predict these by any means, but that's the contrast you're talking about. We get into periods of history in which you can't see. We live in a very short-term environment. We live in a very limited scope, if you will, and we tend to draw our values and our beliefs about the future and whatnot from our immediate experience. And that is, we just have to back up and say that's extremely limited. I mean, I've never lived in a world where there wasn't Social Security. I don't know what you guys call that in New Zealand, but it's status tyranny. It's a welfare state.
Yeah, we just call it social welfare or
social welfare. I've never lived in a time when there wasn't public schooling, and that wasn't considered the norm by 99% of the people.
Yeah,
but if you go back in my country's history before 1830, there were no government schools. There were none. People homeschooled, or they private schooled, or they had private tutors. There was not this vast machinery of dumbing people down into these little automatons for the state. And so my scope is very limited, and I have to step back and review the history over decades and centuries before I start to get a picture that, hey, man, there's something better out there. And when you come to biblical history, you get that even on a much grander scale, because you get the story of the Exodus. You get the stories of David, who's running from a state that's trying to kill him, even to the point he has to go hide in a cave in fear for his life. And yet God turns that situation around and eventually puts him on the throne. And he doesn't do a whole lot better than his predecessor did, but he does better. So if we back up and say, look at the long scope here. Yeah, there are these patterns, but they're all compressed within short times. And there are periods of relief in here in which you can see that there are advances made. You know, as bad a tyranny as the United States has turned into internationally, you know, has there ever been a form of government as, well, I'm not going to say as great. I'm not one of those kind of Americans. But was there ever a paralleled experience to the American Revolution prior to that? Well, maybe one place, not many.
Just after it, there was Haiti. Haiti was the second country in the world to become a republic and to overthrow their slave masters.
Okay. And then once America did it, you saw it, versions of it somewhat in other places. And so this represents an advance in history that had not been there before. And I'm a believer in advance in history over long periods of time. And I think that's what Scripture teaches. And I think it teaches us that this is a very slow process, very difficult process.
See me, I believe in the cover-up of history in order to conceal scumbaggery.
Well, there's a lot of that, too. It depends on who's writing it, right?
It's like, what was it in the start of the film, Braveheart? History is written by those who have hanged heroes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Joel,
that's a big part of it. Yeah. One of the great things about a lot of the biblical history is that it presents its heroes, warts and all, to use Cromwell's phrase. You know, you'll have a David who's this great national leader who brings a great government into play, but you'll also find out that behind the scenes he committed all these gruesome acts, and he was not the kind of guy you would invite to the dinner party. So, you know, it shows you the guys in their worst light possible, so that you don't get this impression that here are guys just writing the history to reinvent themselves or whatever.
So it wasn't written by PR people, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and there's probably some of that here and there,
yeah.
Depending on what side of things you would be on. But
Joel, we've come into break just now. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, with Joel McDermott. Joel, do you have a website just quickly before we go?
Absolutely. AmericanVision.org.
AmericanVision.org.
Access all my articles, our store, and everything else. So
Okay. And just bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead, make my news. And go ahead, make a donation or start up a regular automatic payment into the Kiwi Bank account, if you happen to be a Kiwi, or the PayPal options there. We also are sponsored by the High Tea Cafe, Blue Shield, and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. God damn, I love saying the word Wagga Wagga. Isn't there some kind of a really, really sexy frog, you know, like he was trying to pick up a female frog or something? Wagga Wagga. That's really weird. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now the final segment with Joel McDermott. Would you be technically qualified as like some kind of a biblical scholar? Does that work?
Yeah, actually, I could be a professor at a university or a seminary if they would have me. that's the bigger part of the problem. I tend to be too radical for any of the mainstream guys, but anyway.
Is that by chance because you tell the truth and your opposition are basically just telling one of two different sets of lies and they don't like the fact that you put them to shame?
Yeah, of course, that's my side of the story, right? I mean, you know.
There's three sides to every story. There's two sides of BS and one little kernel-y nugget of truth in the middle there, isn't it?
That's right. Three sides of the story, yours, mine, and the truth. So, yeah, I mean, I am credentialed to teach what I've studied. So, and really, I did my dissertation in the area of dogmatic history, so I could teach either Christian theology or history, early modern history, without much problem. But you know, in my research and writing into my ministry, I've covered a lot more ground. I've written a lot on American history. I just put out a small ebook on Teddy Roosevelt, who was, as I titled the book, the American fascist there. So I've covered a lot of ground in those areas. I could work at a university, no problem at all. I've published a couple of articles in peer-reviewed academic journals. So I am, if you said, what do you do? I would say you could call me a Bible scholar, certainly. But, you know, I find more fulfillment in working this ministry, in dealing with the public more often, being able to reach out to lay people, and, as you said, tell the truth that other people won't tell. And, you know, a lot of times it causes conflicts, hurt feelings. People have their, you know, their tidy little worldviews upturned, and that disturbs people. But I see that as part of the ministry, to be able to enter into somebody's life who's, you know, turned their worldview upside down and show them that what errors they've made and the danger that comes out of it, specifically in foreign policy and in law and things of that nature.
Have you found by not only ignoring that reality it's dangerous, but in being the person to expose that reality to somebody else, it puts you in danger? I saw a great Facebook picture that says, when you're right and the state is wrong, you're in trouble.
I haven't had much backlash from the state itself yet. I have had...
I wasn't referring specifically to the state giving you backlash. I'm talking about just more ordinary people who have lived their entire lives in a dream.
Yeah.
And you're violently waking them up from that dream, and they really don't like it. They want to go back to sleep.
Right. There is some of that. There's a lot of, you know, I don't take a lot of it seriously. I mean, I live in the United States, so I conceal carry 24/7. So I'm never too worried about something like that. But I've had a couple of guys get in the message or the comments at the end of articles and whatnot, and just they talk real tough. But usually it's a 60-year-old guy who's a former Army vet who's probably disabled, not married, and he's probably lonely. He's got nothing else to do, sit at home and, you know, gripe on his computer. So I haven't had a serious problem with that yet. I'm not saying it couldn't happen by any means. I have had death threats that, you know, you always have to take those somewhat seriously. But no, I haven't had too much of that.
Nothing physically coming at you.
No, but I do get a considerable amount of backlash. The good side of it is that as our ministry grows and we persuade a considerable number of people, we tend to get just as much positive feedback as we do negative. And the negative tends to go away over time, because if they stick around arguing for very long, they can't prevail. And, you know, so I'm encouraged in that respect. For as far as what feedback there is, I'm very encouraged. And it's a great thing. It's a great thing to be able to, you said a while ago, you know, why would they not welcome me in these universities or seminaries? Because I tell the truth and put them to shame. Well, some of that happens. Some of that certainly happens, but I think you're finding very slowly a wider variety of guys who are waking up to the truth and realizing that the positions that have been held, specifically in what's been called historically dispensationalism, is just completely untenable. And anybody who you seriously tries to hold that position and maintain any facade of being a university professor just ends up looking like a total idiot at the end of the day. And so that's, especially since about the mid-80s and 90s, has slowly faded away, and we're seeing a phenomenon there of attrition. The old guys that held that position are dying off or retiring. The new guys coming in are holding modified positions, and they may still be supporters of Israel, but they're nowhere near what was there the year before or the generation before. So there is progress. It's slow, but there is progress.
Well, so three topics that I find that are very, very dangerous to talk about on the radio. One's Israel, the other is race, and the other is sex. You know, it's just
In American culture, you say you never talk about politics, sex, or religion.
Yeah.
And I make a pretty good habit of talking about all three.
Yeah. Well, I think it's through politics that a lot of these old ugly men continue to get sex.
That's absolutely true.
Because it's like Henry Kissinger said, "Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac." Did that sound pedophilic enough? I think. Let me see if I can do it worse. I'll just restrain myself for a moment there, because that's just going overboard.
We get the point.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I have a friend of a friend who had a guy he had a friend that was a lobbyist in D.C. and he came back with a very similar assessment. He said, you know, if you can't handle their booze and you can't handle their prostitutes, then you don't need to be there, because that's what makes everything run in D.C.
Somebody once said that politics is show business for ugly people.
Well, that's certainly true on the left. I guess maybe on the right too. I don't know.
Yeah. Is there much of a difference between left or right? Because it occurs to me that basically the left and right wing parties of all of our Western nations now are merely status that dress up and share each other's policies and then go to sex orgies at Rothschild houses like an Eyes Wide Shut later on.
Yeah, I you know, you can never know exactly how much of that to trust, but it doesn't surprise me at all. After studying, I spent a good deal of time studying the occult traditions coming down from Giordano Bruno and a bunch of the others through the formation of the Freemasonic organizations and all of their connections and their influences in American history and continuing even into the churches, especially Baptist and Methodist churches in the United States, but also Presbyterian and Episcopal. It is widespread, and you know, you can get an idea that there is influence there, and there is nonsense like that goes on. And in some places, I look at certain signs and logos, and I can see the influence through symbols. But you don't know exactly how far it goes, and those movies like that make you wonder how bad is it. But you know, when people are enslaved to systems like that, which is nothing but an enslavement to lust, they become very predictable and very controllable people. And so I don't attribute to them omniscience and omnipotence, if you will. And that's one of the areas where my hope is, because as a Christian, I look at Scripture and I see the doctrine of a God who's all-powerful, all-wise, and I see men who want to be that, and who make every effort to be that God, but they're not him. There's as far from him as finite is from infinite. And yet they create institutions, they create doctrines, they use every trick in the book, every lie in the book, every murder, and every dirty thing there is in the book to try to maintain that stance. Statism is, by the way. What is statism? It's the attempt of man to pretend he's the divine, the God.
It's Statonism.
Yeah, you can call it that. I mean, you've got philosophers like George Hegel, who literally said that the state is the expression of the divinity on earth. It is the march of the divinity on earth. I mean, this is...
And which one of the divine servants got cast down to earth, though, I wonder?
If you want to call him divine, he's not natural by any means, but...
Yeah, well, technically he only killed like 17 people in the Bible, whereas God killed 3.5 million, but we're not going to split hairs here or something.
Well, and again, that's one of the classic arguments against biblical history, but what did you call them while ago? What did you call this state? I mean, I forget exactly what term you use, but it's a mafia. It's a professional mafia. And you have mobs and mobs of people who back that mafia enthusiastically, hoping that you'll drop bombs on the next mafia across the next border.
Yeah.
And when history gets to that point and people choose to live that way, there are periods in history in which God says, you know what, that's the end of it. I've given you far more time to repent of this nonsense. I've given you far more time to return to sense and common sense and love for your neighbor and to create a society based on the principles I've given you. And so he inflicts judgments in history. And I would say the number's far beyond 3.5 million. It's probably far higher than that. I was just thinking about this.
I was told on a show yesterday about the monkey experiment where they got 5 monkeys in a basement and put some bananas up the top of the stairs. And as soon as one monkey goes for the bananas, they spray every monkey with cold water. And eventually, yes, they stop going for it because every monkey that tries, they beat them up. So they start replacing the monkeys out one by one. And the new monkey will go up, try to get the bananas, and the other monkeys will beat him up. And then he'll stop trying to go get it. And then they'll introduce a new one, and a new one, and a new one. Until eventually, there's not a single monkey there that's ever been sprayed with water. They're all just beating each other up, preventing them to go for the bananas, because that's the way it's always been done. And that's not entirely dissimilar from how public schooling works, not entirely dissimilar from how belief in statism works, not entirely dissimilar from how people could view everything in their life, whether that be feminism, chauvinism, any form of ism, really. Oh, yes, it's just the way it's always been.
Of course, I heard that experiment too. It's really eye-opening, and it's powerful. It's a testimony to the power of tradition, and brainwashing is what it is. And I would add to your long list there religion as well. I mean, I'm sitting here speaking as a Bible scholar on behalf of the Bible and particular view of Christianity, but you know, we're not exempt either. I mean, our guys have screwed up and sometimes royally in history and have used scripture and used scriptural principles as means of tyranny just as much as anything else, because it is a powerful means of social control. And you can get all people thinking one way, it's easy to move them as a herd. And so, like you said, whether that's feminism or chauvinism or whatever ideology it may be, it becomes a powerful tool of statism. And that's why I think it's important to go back and look at the social theory that's embedded in biblical law, biblical history, and the teachings of Jesus, and realize this is a strongly anti-state message here, because that is the one place where we can stop this. Even if you have all the people holding one set of beliefs or one set of goals or whatever, you're not supposed to have a state where you can coerce people, whether it's through money, whether it's, as they say, through the carrot or the stick, to herd them into doing mass evil, whether it's warfare or programs like public schooling or welfare, whatever.
You know how difficult it would be, so difficult to force to get everybody to totally agree with everything you say and go off and kill people if they all thought for themselves and didn't believe authority blindly. And that was
absolutely.
I mean, these are the two principles I believe should be taught in every school until such a time as we don't need these frickin' schools anymore. In my opinion, they're probably enforcing their own need right now. It's kind of like if you start feeding a pigeon out of a hole in the side of the wall or something like that, and he thinks every time he presses that button he'll get some reward for it. That's kind of how the school works. You'll never learn how to fly and gather your own seed.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, so to speak, at this point in history. And it really was designed that way. In my book, Restoring America, One County at a Time, I have a whole chapter on education, and I talk about what I mentioned earlier. Before 1830 in the United States, there were no government schools. Everybody was either homeschooled or went to a private tutor or was educated in a church. And so I think 1830 is not that long ago. It's not that ancient history, you know. And even by the time you get to the Civil War, you've only got a few hundred public schools versus several thousand private schools in the United States. So it took a while. It was not until the late 19th century that you really had a turn toward public schooling. And so the question is, how do we lose that mentality? How do we go from being a free people who would never succumb to the concept of government education funded by property taxes, which is just unbelievable tyranny in the eyes of our founders, and go through the Civil War, come up just, I mean, less than 100 years later, and the next thing you know, public schooling is the norm, and there are very few people living who didn't understand anything else. How do we make that transition?
There's an old lesson, I think, in history here, that no generation is any more than one or two generations away from tyranny.
Absolutely. That was a famous quote from Reagan, something to that effect, who was also something of a tyrant himself.
Hey, I made up a joke about that. What do hardcore right-wingers put in their spaghetti bolognese?
And haven't heard.
Oregano.
Yeah, just keep that one to yourself at the dinner party. Shakespeare said that...
Apparently it's a very fragrant herb.
Yeah, puns are the death of wit, but that's all right.
Incidentally hates other herbs.
So,
particularly psychoactive ones. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so I'm talking about this issue of education, especially historically, and how did we get to this point? And I look back and there were several explanations for things that took place. And one of the big ones was the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And you had the tremendous advance of giant corporations in American history. Of course, it happened all over the industrialized West. And once the corporations got a hold of things, they needed workers. They needed assembly line workers, especially. So they became tremendous proponents of public schooling, because public schooling was really this mechanism for turning out these little automatons who didn't think for themselves, who didn't question their existence in life, who were taught from day one over the process of 12 years of schooling that you get up when you're told to get up, you sit down when you're told to sit down, you be quiet. When the bell rings, you go to the bathroom. When the bell rings again, you get a drink of water. When it rings again, you have lunch. You know, when the bell rings, so we're talking about Pavlov's dogs here. When the bell rings, you go sit back deck at your desk and you be quiet, you do your work, you do what you're told. And at the end of 12 years of this nonsense, you've got a guy who doesn't question his existence. He falls in line. He knows how to walk in a single file line. He knows how to take orders. And these people left the graduation table, the graduation ceremony in high school, and walked right into the next building, which is the nearest factory, and applied for a job and went into the assembly line. And it was the exact same thing over and over. When the bell rang, you did what you're supposed to do. And you went to lunch, you went to the bathroom, you got your drink of water. You didn't question your existence. And so during the late 19th century, you had a tremendous change between the types of mentalities of people who had founded this country and the people who later became what was called the Gilded Age of American history, which is one of the great misnomers in American history. It was a takeover of the corporations. And then by the time you get to the turn of the century, last century, you have basically what was a fascist state before the term was used to describe fascist states. So, I mean, I'm rambling here, but the point is there are many forces in society that want to keep people dumb. And it's the government, it's the state, it is the leftists, it's several ideologies, and it is the corporations. I just put out an article today on corporate subsidies. It's just mind-blowing to think that over the past 10-year span, I think it was, that there have been $1.2 trillion in direct corporate subsidies in the United States. I'm not even talking about indirect things like tax breaks and whatnot. I'm talking about direct handouts, direct loans, direct guarantees, et cetera, to the top 100 countries in this companies in this country. And it still goes on. And it's the status quo. And freedom will never be gained as long as there's this stranglehold on society by the government, the banks, and the corporations.
Joel, have you looked into the research and the documentaries of Clint Richardson, The Corporation Nation?
No, I haven't. Guess I have.
You and him would get along really, really well. He's looked into the SEC and the background, and what you said just then reminded me of what his research found, is that the U.S. government actually has a major shareholding in the top companies in America. They own like 30% of McDonald's and like 40% of GE and or something like that. Like, basically, the reason why these governments are giving these handouts and everything is they're actually doing it in exchange for stock. And people don't realize that the government actually already owns major shareholdings in all these massive companies which people think are private.
Well, I'd definitely be interested in taking a look at that, because that's
it's socialism by stealth.
If nothing else, I mean, the fact that many of these large corporations are holding government bonds as a tremendous part of their portfolios and assets is says.
And I wonder who told them to do that.
and they're taught from day one that that's the safest investment to make that there is. Period. Backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which means the barrel of the United States government's gun. But you know, like you were saying, they're hand and fist, and that's why I call it fascism, because that's what fascism is. One of the major facets of fascism, I can't even speak those words at the same time, apparently, is this alliance between the national government and the corporate state, the corporations, national corporations, however you want to put it, and that alliance, and it becomes over time a revolving door. The cabinets and the bureaucratic positions in government end up being peopled by the executives who take a leave of absence for 8 years to go work in the Bush administration or whatever, you know. And so you get these guys who are Monsanto lawyers ending up on the Supreme Court deciding cases in favor of Monsanto. You get guys that are working for the FDA that were executives for the drug companies and all that kind of stuff. It's just a revolving door over and over, and you can find it in many places. And when you have that relationship and nobody really has a good plan or strategy or ability to break through and put an end to it, it's just a recipe for tyranny. And the greatest hope you can have is that someday it runs out of other people's money to keep going, that you have some kind of national bankruptcy. But in the meantime, you know, I look at all that and I can get upset about it. And I do like to keep my finger on its pulse to know what's going on. But when I look at it, I think, yeah, I can't change that. You know, I can talk about it on the radio, and that's fine. Somebody may hear it that can do something. That's great. I'll be the first one to preach wherever I have the opportunity to preach. And yet the main things I can do are to speak to my local government, train my own children, you know, keep my own backyard in line, and to look for opportunities to serve other people, because, you know, that's what's been put in front of me. If, for example, you know, God somehow put me in a position to be governor of the state of Georgia, well, I'd obviously have a much larger platform. But until that day comes, I speak to who I'm given to speak to, and that is my wife, my children, the people in my church, the people in my neighborhood, community, and the, you know, the people who follow me in my ministry online and on Facebook, on social media. And it's encouraging in those circles to see that when you start small and you be faithful in what you're doing and consistent, that you do make small headway. And when you consider that there are other people doing this, it's not just me, it's you. And it's not just you, it's me. And it's the people listening to you, and it's the guy who's our mutual friend who recommended us both. You know, these networks go out there for a long way, and each one of these people is doing what they can where they can. And the great miracle, if I can use that word, that God's given us in our generation is the internet, is this great massive decentralization of power when it comes to media and information. And I'd never heard of Lou Rockwell before. I think it was 1999 or so when he put his website up, or when someone forwarded me on via email or website a link to his site. You probably know about Lou Rockwell and the Mises Institute. Here's a libertarian and an anarcho-capitalist think tank. Who would have ever thought there would even be such a thing? And it's got hundreds of thousands of followers, if not millions of followers worldwide. And that would have been unthinkable 40 years ago, or even 30 years ago. And so the web has given us this decentralization of power, and it's beginning to chip away at the power of the great state alliances. I mean, you look at Wikipedia or WikiLeaks. Whatever small things he's accomplished, I mean, here's one guy with a thumb drive who put the entire nation, National Security Agency, in a frenzy. They're scared to death over this stuff. They're mobilizing international governments to arrest the guy.
This is Snowden we're talking about, eh? Because he was just in a public meeting here in New Zealand not a few days ago, exposing how much the NSA is actually in this country to this day. And we've just found out through a number of sources that these cables that the NSA are coming into are going directly into New Zealand military bases, where they have secret spy centres and things of that nature. These are the allegations. We've got to confirm the reports first, because I'm probably going to go out to the airbase at Whenuapai, just north of where I am now, with a giant megaphone and go, "Hey, bro, have you guys got any super secret spy crap in there that you're trying to hide? You know, is it?
Yeah.
No, you don't have any super secret spy stuff. I suppose you wouldn't tell me if you did, no."
Yeah, and in a way, it's kind of quite laughable, because you've got a major international intelligence agency spying on another major international intelligence agency or government. And yeah. And what are they accomplishing by doing this? They're just showing what big goofs they are.
Yeah.
And then you got a guy like Snowden who can take a thumb drive and just crash their party and put them running in circles like the old proverbial, forgive my racism, Chinese fire drill.
Yeah.
You know, and
I mean, it gives a whole new meaning to thumbs up their asses, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'd like to see a whole lot more of those, actually.
Well, Rogel, unfortunately, we have run out of time for the broadcast today. I would really love it if you'd quickly plug your own works and services. And I'm chatting with Clint Richardson from the Corporation Nation off air right now as we speak as well. So we're going to get you two together, and he's going to interview you on his radio show. How about them apples?
Hey, that sounds great. It's like I said earlier, we're making those relationships work, right? I'm Joel McDermott. I work for the American Vision. You can find my website at americanvision.org. We post articles almost daily on topics like this. We have all kinds of resources for us, ranging the spectrum from Christian apologetics to Christian ethics and America's Christian history, and all kinds of government and political issues. My latest book was Restoring America One County at a Time. All kinds of good stuff in there. You can find it all at AmericanVision.org. And Vinny, I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you so much for your time, Joel. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in to this particular broadcast. Thank you so much for doing it. We have a number of sponsors that we'd really love you to check out. The Blue Shield, to protect yourself from EMF and EMR radiation. Not entirely sure if it'll dissipate the scumbaggery of the scumbags that rule over you, but you never know. Other than that, this is a listener-supported broadcast, and it would be very much appreciative if you'd go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. And if you are a New Zealand listener, please have a look at that Kiwi Bank there and consider making a monthly donation of $5 or more. And if you happen to be overseas, there is a PayPal option for you available there as well. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again sometime.